Welcome to the Old Langford History Podcast, Episode 10, ENN Beginnings and the Niagara Canyon. I'm your host, Sue Harper. They say that if you put your ear to the railroad track, you'll hear the sounds of the trains, the whistles, the hissing of the locomotives, and the clickety-clack of the rail cars, past and present. As this is the 10th episode of the Old Langford History Podcast, I wanted to bring you a subject whose history has been plagued with squabbles and controversy, but has also created a strong feelings of nostalgia, and both still continue to this day, over 138 years later. Before I start, I'd like to give a thank you to Kara Middleton for her continued support in the creation of monthly episodes for your enjoyment. I hope you'll also consider joining Kara in supporting this podcast by sponsoring episodes as well. And if you have a business, let me know, and I'll give a shout out to the business. Just check the links in any of the episodes, and you can easily support the podcast in a variety of ways. Back to the railway. It's time to hop on the train and travel through time as we discover some of the history behind the ENN. ENN is short for the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railway. As the railway traverses Langford, I think it's appropriate to discuss its early history, including the building of the huge Niagara Canyon Trestle, also known as the Goldstream Trestle, located on the western border of Goldstream near Langford. I'll also describe from newspaper articles of the time some of the workmen's deaths while completing this impressive feat of engineering across the canyon. The original line was intended to go between Esquimalt and Nanaimo. The rail bed was 115 kilometers, or 71 miles in length. Later, it was extended farther north to the Comox Valley. One of the most notable things about this particular line is that it played an integral part of the agreement that brought BC into Canada. At this particular time, it meant significant growth potential, since railways represented the import and export of natural resources such as coal. While construction of the ENN began on April 30, 1884, discussion about the railway and its location started at least 10 years earlier, in 1875. The British colonists stated,
"The points Esquimalt and Nanaimo are infinitely better than any others for the location of the railway. Sir John A. Macdonald has fixed Esquimalt as the terminus. If the trade with China and Japan were to ever come to Canada, it would have to come through Esquimalt. Besides this, there is local traffic of coal, which would make the railway pay."
Despite much local support for its construction, later in 1875, the idea of a railway hit its first roadblock. The Dominion of Canada House of Commons in Ottawa had passed a bill to provide money for the construction of the railway. However, it was rejected by the Senate. They stated it would seem reasonable that the people of British Columbia should construct the railway themselves. The argument on financing continued through 1877. A question was asked in the colonist newspaper.
"What, then, are we to look for? Are we to expect direct aid from England towards building the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railway? If so, we shall reap disappointment. The British taxpayer will not bear any of the colonial burdens except in the case of war."
Things came to a political standstill until May 9, 1883, when an agreement was reached and the Daily Colonist posted the terms between Canada and British Columbia for the building of the railway. Taking information from this document, the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railway Company and their agents and servants shall lay out, construct, equip, maintain, and work a continuous double or single-track steel railway of the gauge of the Canadian Pacific Railway, and also a telegraph line from a point at or near the harbor of Esquimalt to a port or place at or near Nanaimo, with power to extend the line to Victoria and Comox, and to construct branches of settlements. The ENN company itself was to be a corporation, with a total stock of the company of $3 million and divided into shares of $100 each. The Dominion of Canada agreed to pay $750,000 towards construction. British Columbia agreed to grant a large tract of land along the rail line, about 2 million acres. In this era of white settlement and industrial expansion, The concept of Aboriginal title and their rights to land had been rejected by BC's colonial officials. So at no point was there any acknowledgement or discussion of First Nations lands, which the railway would be built through. Colonial powers essentially privatized roughly 2 million acres along southeast Vancouver Island in the 1880s. This amounted to 10% of Vancouver Island. But only a select few well-connected people would reap the bulk of this land grab windfall. The controversy surrounding this ENN land grant still haunts decision-making today. In 1884, the Esquimalt-Nanaimo Railway Company officially announced the details of its organization on April 29th.
The organization of the Esquimalt-Nanaimo Railway Company was yesterday completed. Mr. Robert Dunsmuir, a large capitalist and true son of British Columbia, is president, and Mr. Charles F. Crocker, the American Railway King, is vice president. It was decided to push the work vigorously.
Dunsmuir was the richest man in British Columbia and had a seat in the legislature. He'd made his fortune from coal mining in the Nanaimo area and would make much more. With the establishment of the ENN Railway, it immediately began subdividing the huge grant of land not needed for the railway into parcels and selling it off, making Dunsmuir and his colleagues millions. Dunsmuir, by the way, also held half of the ENN company's shares. And on top of that, he also secured the contract to actually build the railway, and it was agreed that the railway would be built within 3.5 years. In September 1884, wages per day for railway construction were published. It read, "Schedule of wages for white labor on the Esquimalt-Nanaimo Railway. Rock foreman, $3 to $4 a day. Bridge foreman, $3.50. Bridge carpenters, $3. Drillers, $2. Laborers, $1.75. All labor is 10 hours a day with wages paid monthly." On August 13th, 1886, Prime Minister Sir John A. Macdonald drove the last railway spike into the ground along a section above the Malahat Highway, 40 kilometers north of Victoria, near Shawinigan Lake. The original cost of constructing the railway was $626,000 per mile. In 1892, weekend fare was 75 cents return from Victoria to Goldstream and $1.50 to Shawinigan Lake. Besides the movement of natural resources, the ENN provided another way for Victorians to gather at Langford and Goldstream, which was essentially the playground for Victorians at the time. Goldstream in particular was, and still is, renowned for its beauty. Now the ENN Railway runs through the western side of Goldstream, up through the ridge of mountains of the Malahat area. The railway crossing of Niagara Canyon, also known as the Goldstream Trestle, is at mile 14 from Victoria and a dizzying 260 feet above the stream bed. It was a highlight of the railway trip. While the scenery is magnificent, the history of the bridge carrying the line across this canyon is worthy of note. Niagara Canyon was first bridged in the summer of 1885, 2 years after the syndicate headed by Dunsmuir secured the contract to build the ENN. A.J. McClellan was awarded the contract to prepare approximately 22 miles of right-of-way from Esquimalt to Cliffside above the shore of Shawinigan Lake. This was one of the most difficult areas of construction. Reported on May 19, 1885, in The Colonist.
"About 100 whites and 250 Chinese are engaged in this McClellan subcontract. There are several extensive rock cuttings and very deep fills, and also a tunnel 200 feet on this 5-mile stretch. The bridge crossing the deep ravine shall soon be erected."
According to McClellan's daughter Winifred, in a letter written in 1971, she recalls that the 7-month contract of the Malahat, which her father had, in those 7 months, 1,050 men had, in the course of building 22 miles of grade, blasted through 5 miles of heavy rock work, drilled a short tunnel, and bridged several gullies and canyons, including Niagara Canyon. This trestle was one of many wooden trestles built on the line over the Malahat. It needed 400,000 board feet of timber and carried the railway above the Niagara Creek. This wooden trestle remained in place for nearly 30 years after its construction. The original bridge was actually located a few hundred feet from where the present bridge is and was on a slight curve. When you could access the area, you could still see the rock cutting through which the tracks were brought to the original trestle and the impressions of the ties, although this original bridge has vanished. Disaster struck the wooden trestle on November 14, 1896. The center section of the trestle was washed out and destroyed in extreme heavy rain. The article read, "Swollen rivers seriously interfere with traffic. Although the incessant rain from the last few days has made its presence felt in Victoria, it has produced much more serious results." There was a 3.5-hour delay in the arrival of yesterday's train from Nanaimo. The trestle bridge across the Niagara Canyon, a little above Goldstream, having been carried away in the night, and the passengers both north and southbound being obliged in consequence to walk a little more than a mile in order to connect with the trains either side of the break. The fallen trestle is one of the biggest on the line. It was through the blocking of this canyon that debris was carried by the swollen mountain stream and the bridge came to grief, and it is not at all likely that effort will be made to replace it. Instead, it is understood that the company will as speedily as possible proceed with the erection of a substantial steel and stone structure carrying out a plan of line improvement. For the immediate future, passengers will depend on getting through by walking between points, or they may take a steamer. The afternoon train today is cancelled, but the morning train will go on in the usual manner, carrying only such hand baggage as passengers take in their own care. Dynamite was brought in to clear away debris from the broken trestle. At the center section, it was now just a huge gap. According to newspaper accounts, the ENN considered replacing the wooden structure with a steel bridge, but this was beyond the company's financial means, and the damaged section was to be rebuilt. But it was not until January 12, 1897 that the trestle was fully repaired. In 1905, the ENN was purchased from the Dunsmuir family by the Canadian Pacific Railway, who immediately looked at improving the line. One of the first projects was the Niagara Canyon. It needed to withstand heavier trains being operated along the line and avoid any future washouts. On April 23, 1909, the Daily Colonist announced that the CPR would spend $120,000 to install a new cantilever steel bridge over the canyon. Work on the piers and abutments would start immediately, and it was hoped the upgrade would be finished by the end of the year.
The most important new work is the installation of a steel bridge at Niagara Canyon. Already, preparations are being made. It will be rushed to completion. The steel will be forwarded from the east as soon as possible.
While work was underway, an event in January 1910 drew police to the site and recorded one of the first deaths, although under strange circumstances. George Roberts, employed by the ENN, wandered into the bush and had gone missing. An article in the local newspaper, January 5th, described the situation. Believed to be mentally unbalanced and his whereabouts a mystery ever since he disappeared last Saturday night into the woods of Niagara Canyon, George Roberts, a section hand on the ENN railway, is now the object of a search. Joseph Barlow of Goldstream was engaged by the police to hunt for the missing man. Roberts was at work on the line. Sometime later, the section foreman, Jay Thompson, when going along the railway tracks at the canyon, discovered the speeder used by Roberts standing on the rails, but no sign of Roberts. A trail leading into the snow towards the bush followed where Roberts had disappeared. But once under the trees, the trail was lost. Mr. Thompson returned to Goldstream and notified the bartender at the hotel, who in turn notified provincial police. Roberts of late had been acting strangely, and it was believed he had become insane. In the present condition of weather, there is little hope entertained for his life, should he have remained in the bush. On January 6, it was reported, "Nude body of George Roberts found, lying on the trail in the mountains about a mile and a half from Goldstream, the body of George Roberts was found. He had removed every vestige of clothing except for his boots, and in the nude condition had apparently wandered about until overcome with exhaustion and succumbed to the extreme cold. The body was discovered by Joseph Barlow. Roberts had also been employed as a laborer on the new residence at Hatley Park by James Dunsmuir, and had worked at Niagara Canyon for the ENN the last few weeks. His body was brought down on a sleigh to Goldstream and then taken to the city by train. George Roberts' death certificate can be found at the BC Archives. He was 40 years of age and was listed as a laborer born in England. The date of his death was written as January 2, 1910, and the cause of death deemed an accident. By the end of 1910, work was still underway on the new bridge. Then on January 14, 1911, another death occurred. This time, a man initially considered to be a vagrant had been hit by a freight train. It seems that workers would occasionally use the ENN tracks as a way to walk into town from the Niagara Canyon work camp, or maybe to go to Goldstream Inn. A letter to the editor wanted justice to the dead, stating,
"We, the members of the Mason Gang of the Niagara Canyon, wish injustice to the dead to contradict the report that Joseph O'Brien, recently killed on the ENN track Saturday night, was a vagrant. He had been working 3 or 4 months at the Niagara Canyon and had a tent and other property. He was a steady worker, and during the months he was with us, he was only twice in town. Had the deceased been a man of substance, all his faults would have been forgotten and his good points only brought before the public gaze, rather than lead one to believe he was better off dead. Signed, the Mason Gang of Niagara Canyon."
Joseph O'Brien is listed only briefly in the BC Archives, indicating the date of his death and that he was 60 years of age. Work continued on, as reported in The Colonist, November 11th. From this day forth, the actual installation of the new steel bridge at Niagara Canyon on the ENN will proceed without interruption. The material to be used is coming every day. The steel was taken out of the Fraser River. The new Niagara Canyon structure will be one of an absolute permanent character and is only the beginning of the policy initiated by the ENN company to replace all timber trestles. The bridge was to be supported on 2 piers and 2 abutments, all constructed of masonry block, pointed with mortar and backfilled with rubble. Then the steel workers could construct the bridge. But as work proceeded, another accident occurred and was reported on October 12, 1911. The announcement in the paper was entitled, "Hurled to Death." Struck by a swinging girder, which was to be put into place on the new steel bridge at Niagara Canyon on the ENN Railroad, Harry Swanson, a steel worker, was unseated from his lofty position and fell 100 feet below to his death at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. The girder caught the young man so heavily that it is likely he was stunned before he fell. When picked up a few minutes later, his life was extinct. Swanson had come from Seattle, where he had been a steel worker. Little is known of him at camp, but relatives have been communicated with. His remains will likely be brought to the city today. He was listed as being 28 at the time of his death. It was not until the end of October 1911 that The Colonist finally informed its readers that the new steel bridge would soon be ready for traffic.
"Work on the new ENN steel bridge at Niagara Canyon is almost completed. Officials expect it will be possible to make regular passenger and freight trains over it before the expiration of a fortnight."
It was also boasted in 1911 that the passenger train from Victoria to Duncan took only 2 hours via the ENN. Of interesting note, the Niagara Canyon steel bridge was not new at all, but actually older than the Esquimalt to Nanaimo Railway itself, from the time of the construction of the CPR across British Columbia. The bridge was first used on the mainland over the Fraser River at Cisco, 48 miles north of Yale. At the time, the bridge cost over $250,000, making it the most expensive structure on the CPR's mainland. The steel for the bridge was fabricated in England, specifically by Hawkes, Crashay & Company of Gateshead, England. Charles C. Schneider was the engineer who designed the bridge. The bridge was shipped from England around the Horn to San Francisco and then to Port Moody. On June 12, 1884, the Fraser River Cisco Bridge was opened to great fanfare. But after 30 years, it was no longer adequate for the increasing weight of the CPR mainline trains. I'm not sure when the bridge was removed from the Fraser, but with the announcement in 1909 that the Niagara Bridge at Goldstream would be replaced with the Cantilever Bridge, suggests plans were already in the works by the CPR. Its relocation to the Niagara Canyon in 1911 received very little attention in the newspapers and not much fanfare. Maybe the installation of a second-hand bridge rather than something new and shiny didn't perk a reporter's interest, despite its 161-meter, or 529-foot length, and 260-foot height. As you can see, the ENN Railway, just in its early years, had a lot of history. The decisions made back then still resonate today, as its future hangs in the balance. The Great Cantilever Bridge over the Niagara Canyon was an impressive feat of engineering for its time and can still be viewed from the bottom of the canyon. Nothing much has changed from its original fabrication 139 years ago. If you do hike to the area, look up and imagine those bold, fearless workers constructing it 260 feet up, with girders being guided into place and hammers pounding away to make them secure. The remaining lifespan of the Niagara Canyon Bridge is unknown, but I wonder if those workers knew it would still be in place today. Thanks for listening to episode 10 of the Old Langford History Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and learned a little more about the early history of the ENN and the Niagara Canyon Bridge. Don't forget to tell others about the Old Langford History Podcast. I'm Sue Harper, and we'll be back with more interesting episodes soon.